faces and all of the places, wondering where they all disappear. I didn't ponder the question too long. I was hungry and went out for a bite. Ran into a chum with a bottle of rum, and we wound up drinking all night. It's those changes in latitudes, changes in attitudes. Nothing remains quite the same. All of our running and all of our cunning, if we couldn't laugh, we would all go insane. Meeting departure signs in some big airport reminds me of the places I've been. Visions of good times that brought so much pleasure makes me want to go back again. If it suddenly ended tomorrow, I could somehow adjust to the fall. Good times and riches and son of a bitches, I've seen more than I can recall. These changes in latitudes, changes in attitudes, nothing remains quite the same. Through all of the islands and all of the highlands, if we couldn't laugh, we would all go insane. I think about Paris when I'm out red wine. I wish I could jump on a plane. So many nights I just dream of the ocean. God, I wish I was sailing again. Oh, yesterday's over my shoulder, so I can't look back for too long. There's just too much to see waiting in front of me, and I know that I just can't go wrong. With these changes in latitude, changes in attitudes, nothing remains quite the same. With all of my running and all of my cunning, if I couldn't laugh, I just would go insane. We couldn't laugh, we just would go insane. We were all crazy, we would go insane.
You know, I think that was Jimmy Buffett, but I'm not sure. Yeah, terrible Tommy here. Can't see my clock. Wait a minute. My Frank Silva Memorial clock. Yeah, it's the 4th. Yeah, the 4th of September 2015. And this is Terrible Tommy in north central Indiana near the capital of Poland. No, wait a minute. Warsaw, Indiana. Yeah. This is a county that Washington gave a whole lot of this territory out here that was the wild and woolly frontier to Count Kosciuszko, who helped in the fight against the British. And then they, I guess, divvied it all up, and the land speculators came in, and all of a sudden Kosciuszko County was not Polish anymore. It was all German. And all the Poles went north to South Bend, which is about 50 miles away, and they ended up there, because that's where the foundries were, and they seemed to gravitate to the foundry work. The Germans out here gravitated to the farming. Yeah, so anyhow, we got a Polish name here, but we got a pretty much German population. Or as David Duke would say, these are European Americans. European Americans, every one of them. Not white Americans, European Americans. Not racist, not white supremacist, white nationalist. They're white nationalist. Well, that song went out to the She-Wolves. This is Freya's Day in the Bunker, right here next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we only pump ethyl and regular. None of that newfangled stuff. Yeah. None of that corn octane stuff. We want the real stuff. Boy, I got up into the 90s and it was so humid yesterday. I'm not used to that humidity, man. I don't want to go out later in the day around here when it's like that. It's supposed to get up there again. Boy, I'll tell you, that gets to you after a while. I remember as a kid working in the field, making hay and baling hay and all that stuff in 90-degree weather. Jeez, no wonder I didn't have a stroke. Guess that's why I learned how to repair television sets and put up TV antennas way back then. So I didn't have to work in the field. That's another strange thing. When I was a kid around here, they baled hay in rectangular shape. When I came back from the Army, they were rolling it, great big rolls. I'm not sure what the benefit of that is or not, but some of these guys leave those big rolls of hay right out in the field all winter. So I guess after you get through about the first half a foot, it's probably fine. But you know, in the old days when they used to put hay up in a barn, and when I was a kid I used to do that, you know, I handled the trip line for the big forks that come down out of the ceiling, grab the loose hay out of the wagon, take it up there, and then I'd pull it and go over to one side of the barn and pull the clicker, and down it'd come. Well, they did have problems with that loose hay in the hay mow, because every once in a while you'd get that internal combustion thing, that's not the word for it, but anyhow, a fire would start, burn the whole damn barn down. So we don't have that problem now. In fact, there's getting to be less barns around all the time, I'll tell you. Most of the farmers that have been in business around here for a long time, and they're up in their 70s and 80s, hell, they've sold their farm. They're down in Florida on the beach, man. They said, hell with this, we're tired. Well, if you haven't gotten down here and picked up your weapon of mass destruction, your favorite one, you better get gone, because it's going to get cold pretty soon. We close up the weapons of mass destruction in the wintertime. In only emergency can you get a weapon of mass destruction in the wintertime. Because we're all in the bar, Terrible Tommy's bar, drinking. We ain't going to mess around out there in 2 foot of snow getting you a weapon of mass destruction. So now's the time to get it. The whole Middle East and a whole lot of other countries are just, well, hell, you got brand new military, industrial, weapons of mass destruction laying all over the place. But the trouble is, it's starting to get scarce, because ISIS just said, thank you, Uncle Sam, and they picked him up and went off to killing people. I see they chopped the heads off about 25 people the other day. That's interesting. That's an interesting hobby. Well, hell, the French used to do it all the time. So, you know, the French Revolution, they chopped off hundreds of heads. So white men have chopped off heads down through history. That used to be the choice way, and even in England, where they put your head on the chopping block, man. So don't get so excited about ISIS. Actually, I think the guillotine that the French came up with is probably the most, the best way to go. It's fast, it's clean, what's fun about it, you can look back and see your body there for a little bit till the brain shuts down. I wonder what that's like. Well, I see that Germany's getting ready to accept 800,000 invaders from North Africa. Thank you, George Bush Jr. and George Bush Sr. and Dick Cheney, you sons of bitches. You bastards will live in infamy among white radicals out here and white separatists, because you're the one that kicked all this shit off, and it all comes from you, you psychopathic bastards. See, the left and the right, left and I agree on this issue. They are war criminals, should be apprehended, taken to wherever they're going to try them. If they want to try them at The Hague, that's fine. Take them there. Try them, and then have the axemen chop their heads off. There's nothing that you could do to George Bush Jr. and Cheney that would make up for the tremendous deaths all over the world, all over the Middle East, all that depleted uranium they've caused to be spread all over the Middle East. It's going to make it almost unlivable for a long, long time. Or you may live and have a kid with two heads or 4 feet or whatever, you know. That, I mean, you know, it's... And so all these people, like I say, are fleeing these countries because they're unlivable. And then now the countries they're fleeing to are bitching, obviously, because, hey, wait a minute. They're going into Germany and kicking poor white people out of their houses and putting these Middle Eastern people in. I mean, it's absolutely gone insane. I'm telling you, it's just... I can't keep up with this stuff. I mean, it's just so insane that it's just unbelievable. But it is happening right before our eyes. Europe's being destroyed. The United States is being destroyed as basically white areas. And we're destroying all these countries and all their leaders that people were existing pretty well in. You know, may not have been the best. But like one of those guys is fleeing, one of those invaders coming up there from Syria said, Syria was hell, but I'd rather go back and live there and take what I have to take than what's happening to me here, because there's going to be massive uprisings in Europe. You think that people are just going to sit there and take that? You think Germany is going to sit there, the general working class population, and move over for 800,000 people? That's more than any of their major cities, or most of them. You see, our problem is people in high places. Our problem isn't with poor people and even gangbangers. It's the people in charge. We cannot afford on this earth to put up with the people in charge. We can't. They're the worst enemy of the people and the environment and everything else. I mean, you could take the worst gangbanger, white or black or whatever, in the prison is not even one-tenth the danger and the problem of these people in power. It's got to be led in the background by important forces that have something that they want to do with the whole world. I don't see how they're going to come out in the end, because it's going to be a Mad Max world. And if you think, if you're a billionaire and if you think you're going to be able to hide because you got $1 billion, think again. Dawn of the Dead, baby. Somebody will get to you. There's no place you can go. You can have your security. You can have all. You can have the military. You can have any place else. But you're reachable, you bastard billionaires. You are reachable. Let me guarantee you that. Just like in South America, when those cartels want to wipe somebody out, you can have your bulletproof Mercedes. You can have the military following you and trucks and machine guns, but they get you. And so I don't understand the filthy rich, the people that control most of the money in this country and back up all these military adventures. I don't understand them, how they think they're going to escape. Well, some might for a while, but if the masses decide to wipe you out, they're going to wipe you out one way or another, even if it takes a 100, maybe 1,000 people have to die to get to you, they'll get to you. So I don't understand the rich. I understand how greedy they are, but I don't understand how they think they can. It always takes me back to that movie with Al Pacino, where he's the big Cuban heroin dealer, cocaine dealer, and he's living in Miami there. And I've told you this story 100 times, and you've seen the movie where he's in that big mansion, and he's got all the money in the world, he's got all the weapons in the world, he's got all the fences, electrified fences, he's got all that stuff. But those Colombians in bare feet and rags on, get through his defenses and kill him. And that's the way it's going to be. I mean, you know, there's nobody going to be so big they can't be got. And that's one thing we should always remind these people of. I know they don't pay attention to us. Yeah, you got no power, man. These psychopaths say, you guys don't have any power. Well, you know, all the time over there in the Middle East, somebody walks up to somebody and gives them a big hug and pulls the pin or flips the switch, and they're gone. So there is no such thing as total security. I remind the people who are running the show, there is no such thing as total security. So why don't you back off for a while and reverse the process and pull the armies back and pull the Air Force back and quit blowing the shit out of everybody. Do that for a couple of decades, stay out of it, put the military more or less in mothballs, and there might be some peace. And then all these guys that are, they're not rich, or they're not really rich, that are pushing this stuff all the time on radio and TV, believe me, they can be got, because they don't have that much defense. These guys are always promoting war, bomb, 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 and all that stuff. I think they should be taken out. And I hope somebody does take them out. Yeah. Or try them in the court in The Hague. But it's going to be interesting how this plays out, because people on the street are not going to take it forever. They're not going to take it forever. And then it's going to be, Katie, bar the door shut. There's a goddamn man under the bed. And this stupid political game you're all playing and you put out there to keep the sheep in turmoil, it's not going to last. It's not going to last, because you can tell even by the support that Trump's getting, he's hit a lot of nerves, and that's the only thing I like about it. He's bringing us to a natural chaos, and we need a natural chaos. We really need Mad Max. And it's coming. It's coming, baby. Now, one of our good buddies on here asked me to do a little bit more on race. Read a little bit more stuff on race and different aspects of race. So I'm going to go over here in my giant library. It's all around me. And see if I can find something that will make sense to you. I'm sure I can. So hold on. Well, let's read a little article here from Liberty Bell. And it's about Julia Pastrana. Deformed freak or half ape? Longtime readers of various racialist publications may recall the case of Julia Pastrana, whose photo has appeared from time to time along with the brief accounts of her life. She was said to be half ape and half human, born when some 19th century Mexican scientists decided to see if an ape and a human could mate, using sperm from a Negro, so the story goes, they impregnated a female ape, and the result was a horrible-looking offspring whose ape-like characteristics outweighed her human ones. Cared for by the Catholic Church, she has been dead now for over 125 years. Strange as this case may seem, it could be far from unique. Professor Charles Carroll has quoted many authorities who state that sexual couplings of Negroes and apes have been fruitful. An October 1964 issue of Battle Cry magazine carried an article by Dr. Winton Frail, in which he claimed that African negresses have bred successfully with apes. Well, now those half-ape, half-humans are breeding with healthy white Aryans. Details of these matings would be of more interest to the public, but it appears that the case of Julia Pastrana was the only one that ever made any splash. However, even here, the information is sketchy. The three photos I have seen of her are all the same and are copies of one in possession of the Anthropological Institute in London. Of course, information on matings between apes and humans would be distasteful to many people, especially egalitarians, if it should be proven that only couplings between apes and blacks are likely to produce offspring. Having long been curious about Julia Pastrana, I was pleased to finally come upon a book which devoted a chapter to her. The title is Very Special People by Frederick Drimmer, first published in 1973 by Bantam Books. The first thing I turned to was the part devoted to her, and I was not surprised to see that Drimmer avoided any details of her birth. He did, however, tell quite a bit about her life as an adult. Julia Pastrana was born in 1832 and grew to a height of only 4.5 feet. Most of her face was covered with thick growth of black hair, and her arms were also very hairy. Her ears were large, her nose was wide, and the chin prognosis. Her lips were large and teeth irregular, the whole appearance decidedly ape-like. Taken in tow by a showman named Lent, she left Mexico and traveled around the world with him, making him a wealthy man. She was taught to sing Mexican songs and to dance. Author Drimmer mentions that the strange stories were told about Julia, and that those who viewed her often whispered to each other that she could not be completely human. Lent, ever the sagacious showman, saw to it that the public did not see very much of her off the stage, assuming that too much exposure would erode her novelty value and cut down on his gate receipts. Julia was curious about the world, loved to read, and could speak three languages. Francis T. Buckland, the Englishman who wrote Curiosities of Natural History, saw her when she was being exhibited on Regent Street in London in 1857 and spoke with her. He described her features as simply hideous, but admired her figure and did not believe she was half ape. Instead, he felt that she was simply a deformed Mexican Indian woman. Julia was pulling in a lot of money, and rumors began to circulate that other showmen were trying to win her away from Lent. So probably, to his hold on her, he proposed marriage, which she really accepted. In time, Julia was expecting and was on tour in Moscow when she felt the first birth pains. She hoped for a normal child who would resemble his father, her father, and was said to be hardly able to wait to get her first look at the baby, which turned out to be a boy. But when the great moment came, the midwife held him out to her, and she saw instead a carbon copy of herself, insofar as looks and skin color were concerned, and he was also covered with hair. The baby died within 36 hours. They probably didn't feed him. Soon afterwards, Julia herself died, some thought of shock or a broken heart. This was in 1860, when she was 28 years old. Author Drimmer said that nature played Julia Pastrana false, but maybe it was not false at all. If she was, as Buckland believed, simply a deformed Mexican Indian woman, then the odds in favor of her giving birth to a normal child were good. On the other hand, if she indeed was half ape and half Negro, then her offspring would most certainly exhibit strong ape-like characteristics. This is because the most primitive genes are dominant. Thus, the ape genes are dominant over the Negro genes, and the Negro genes are dominant over the white genes. There is no way that the baby could have resembled Lent, the father, who, I assume, was a white man, although his race was not given. I'm not in a position personally to make any positive pronouncements on the genetic makeup of Julia Pastrana. I can only point out that the evidence, especially the birth of her baby, seems to suggest draw your own conclusions. Well, that's why the white race and the genes of the white race have to be protected so well. because the lower animal races tend to be stronger as far as that's concerned. Of course, that does not mean stronger in intellect and so forth like that. It simply means that they're more primitive, and it has to do with survival. So whereas the white Aryan espouses higher intellectual abilities and so forth like that, the animal genes tend downward to a more basic animal survival type person. So when they say, well, blacks are yelling about, well, our genes are more dominant than yours, we're stronger than the white and the melanin and all that, well, they're really arguing against themselves if you know the difference and know that that downbreeding is going back to the more animal nature and also the aspire to survive. And so just because an animal has more survival instincts than a white Aryan does not make the animal smart like the Aryan. So that's the end of that article. You don't have to go that far to see it happening now. The ugliest gorilla-looking Negroes now are mating with well-advanced white women. And the offspring, you can see them all over the place. The people who have promoted mixing of the races, especially mixing of the black and the white, are in truth the Frankenstein doctors of this age. And if there's anyone that you can put the blame for the downfall of civilization on, it is those people. In fact, now they've gotten this idea of we're all equal, taking race completely out of the picture, only using the term ethnicity and so forth like that. But that's where all of this stuff in Europe is coming from, and all this, let them all in. Let them all in. Why not? We're all equal, right? So if we're all equal, let them all in. There's no difference in the races. No difference even in the individuals. So let them all in. See, that all comes out of this. Now, the Christian church has been in the forefront, once it got started, of promoting that. And then your political parties got on board also. So, and then the State Department of this country is allowing almost anybody to come into the country. And there's obviously, I don't believe in the devil, but if there was one, he's right there trying to promote this race mixing and the down breeding of the white man. And whoever is okaying that is your mortal enemy. Absolutely. I think the complex is being put in the white man's and white woman's head through the educational system that you're have inferiority complexes. I mean, I notice it walking down the street or walking any place where there's a crowd. Try something. Look into their eyes. They will look down, or they'll look sideways, or look anywhere, but they won't look you in the eyes. Now that's, as far as I'm concerned, an example of people who have been psychologically diminished through one thing or another, mainly through education and the movies and all that kind of stuff, to where they will not. And I'll tell you another thing, it probably gets you out of a jam too. You see a group of young Negroes coming down the street, and rather than run or something like that, just look them right in the eye. Not with any particular features on your face, just look at them with a deadpan look. Usually they won't bother you because they recognize another predator. So you become the predator. And I'm not saying that's always going to get you out of trouble, but I've used it. I always do that. Whenever I'm approached, especially by non-whites, I look them right in the eye. And usually they never say anything, never do anything. But if you look sideways, look down like you're an inferior, or like you're whatever, you're liable to get jumped and you're liable to get killed or raped. On the radio yesterday, on the PBS radio, there's a program called, let's see, what is it? Fresh Air. And there's a lady, I forget what her name, that handles it. Well, she had a guest on the show that has done a long thing on white nationalism, what they call white nationalism. And it was pretty extensive. And you can get it in the latest New Yorker magazine, or you can go up to Fresh Air and download it. But it was quite extensive about how they're looking at white nationalism and what they think white nationalism is and Trump's effect on white nationalism and so forth. I was going to download it. I haven't had a chance, but if I get a chance, I'll download it into an MP3. Or you can and send it to me, and we'll get it around. Because it's an interesting thing, and this guy, I think, has written a book, too. He went around with all these white nationalist groups and hung out with them, and he thinks he's got it all figured out. He never came around here. Oh, another comment on that psychopathic show I had on yesterday, which I thought was very good. I've come to consider the problem with the Jews is they have a higher percentage of psychopaths in their population. How that came about, I don't know. But I think that's the reason, and the problem is they're not all psychopaths, but there's a higher percentage of psychopaths among the Jewish people. Maybe it comes from the things they study and read or whatever, or tradition, but it's there. Well, I see Jeb Bush has learned how to genuflect to the Jews, just like his whole family have done. Quote, here's what I've learned from having a front row seat to watching history unfold, unquote. Jeb Bush told a packed congregation inside the Hampton Synagogue, which is located in the affluent confines of West Hampton Beach, New York. On both sides of the aesthetically modern, architecturally elegant building, chairs spilled out from its sliding glass walls into the synagogue's sun-drenched grassy courtyard and entryway, just barely accommodating the attendees at last week's Shabbat service. By the way, Bush continued, by running for president, I'm not trying to break the tie between Adam's family and the Bush family. The audience laughed. Being president's about creating highly sustained economic growth to restore America's greatness and establishing America's strength in a way that will create a more peaceful world, unquote. Well, he doesn't seem to understand the strength of America, the United States, and other countries like Canada has been in their race and the genes. It's got nothing to do with, for instance, who's president. The Hamptons in late August remains an epicenter of wealth and power as the elite New York City finished the season holidaying at luxurious seaside resort. Bush's visit was the latest in a series to what appears to be the most desirable synagogue in America for presidential candidates to give fellatio to the rabbis. No, I didn't say that. The synagogue has termed these visits its presidential candidate series, you know, to give homage and kiss ass. And so far, the synagogue has hosted three of the current 17 GOP candidates, former New York Governor George Pataki, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and South Carolina's Senator Lindsey Graham. I knew he'd be there. According to the Jewish Insider, Rubio spoke to a packed crowd of about 700 people in the morning of August 15th and reportedly received several standing ovations. Wow. After speaking about Israel and the Iran deal. That's where they don't want Iran to have any atomic bomb. But Israel can have hundreds of them. What's that all about? After speaking about Israel and the Iran deal, Graham participated in a Q&A session held in the synagogue that evening, telling the crowd, quote, "I'm the biggest voice on the issue you care about," unquote. Pataki spoke at the Shabbat service held the week before. A third Republican presidential candidate, Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, is scheduled to speak at the synagogue Shabbat dinner this Friday evening. Well, isn't that wonderful? Don't forget, Jews, if you don't bend your knee to Jesus when he comes back, the Christians are going to kill all of you. Obviously, they don't believe Jesus is coming back. In a phone interview, the Hampton Synagogue's founding rabbi, Mark Schneier, told me that it was his vision 25 years ago for the synagogue to offer such a function. He said the synagogue pulls in massive crowds each week, and that its congregation contains some of New York City's most influential and affluent families. The program of last week's Shabbat service noted that since the start of 2015, the synagogue has received several single donations of $100,000 or more. The Orthodox synagogue, whose trustees include New York City businessman Jerry Levine and real estate mogul Jay Podolsky, thus offers a wonderful platform for potential leaders to express themselves and their beliefs to these highly influential within the Jewish community. Well, I'm not going to go on with that, but you know what it's all about. You've been around this show enough, you know what's going on. Well, if you live in New York and you can get to Greenwich Village, Alan Dershowitz, Super Kike, will be the headliner this Friday night at the Comedy Cellar, the storied club in Greenwich Village. They probably charge a fortune to get in. That's not a joke, but Dershowitz won't be doing any stand-up. Instead, Harvard Law School professor is part of a panel that will debate the merits of President Obama's Iran deal. He'll be joined by Georgetown professor Matthew Koenig, MIT scholar Jim Walsh, and Slate columnist Fred Kaplan. Dershowitz's most recent book is titled The Case Against the Iran Deal. Boy, he pumps them out. So it is safe to bet that he will not come out in favor of the Iran deal, which now appears to have the Senate backing it needs to survive the congressional challenge. Well, there you go. If you want to see meet and greet old Kike Alan Dershowitz, that's the place to find him. Friday night at that comedy club, the Comedy Cellar in Greenwich Village. Here's a little blurb on death and destruction. What's it all about? They keep bringing up Hitler. Well, he's partially right, because that World War II could have been avoided, and Hitler was just as much responsible as anybody else. So don't kid yourself about that. Don't kid yourself.
Very important to see the structure behind such a person as Hitler. The financial structure behind such a person as Hitler. Because we are looking upon financial structures that finance both sides of conflicts. It's not that they do this. They thrive on death and destruction. That is their game. The more the merrier. The more people they can kill, the more people, the more bombs they can sell, the more weapons they can sell, the more things they can blow up so that they can then replace them, the more villages, the more towns they blow up, then that they can then rebuild all the time on taxpayers' money, or attack innocent countries, then approach them by the World Bank and in the International Monetary Fund, which are their tools, and say, "My God, you're being under attack. We will lend you money now so you can buy weapons and defend yourself. Stand up, man." Okay? So they borrow money, and then they get slaughtered anyway. And not only that, then they have debts that they will never get out. This group invade country by country, different ways. Some people, some countries by military force, other people they destroy financially. Or they go in and they have like financial hitmen that just goes up to the president and say, "Dear Mr. President, would you mind having a cup of tea with me?" The president sits down. He's a very honest decent man. And they said, you know, in this pocket, I have money, amounts that you can't even dream of. And in this pocket, I have a bullet with your name on. What would you choose? And that's how it goes. If they choose and the bullet and say, go on, sort off, Hugo Chavez, many of the strong people in Latin America, they're dead within a month. Dead within a month. Or they take the money and they're totally corrupt, totally in the pocket of these people. Other countries are invaded financially, or they say to the European Union, I'm just going to say things that very quickly, but these are creations by the same elite group. You will see the founders of these things, like the UN, United Nations, the UNICEF, the United Nations Army Force, the NATO, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, created by the same group of people. We're talking Rockefellers, Rothschilds, JP Morgan, these type of financial structures that are behind the conflicts as well. Very important to find who are these people and how are they doing it. And then you will also see how, for instance, we say, oh, these countries in Africa, my God, there can never be peace there because they're always fighting, you know. I mean, it must be because they've got more pigment in their skin than us, because we would never fight like that. I mean, there is a reason that they're starving, but beyond that, I mean, why are they not, you know, like friends and like this? These starvations and famines, check out the history. How did they start? Somalia, for instance, they went in and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, awful, awful organizations, awful. They went in, and this is what just one example. You would see Greece, Italy, many, many, many countries. They go in and they say to this country, you know, we got these loans. You know, we have these incredible opportunities. Now if you got sun all the time, you got all the perfect circumstances to grow cotton. Do that. That's excellent. Everybody should do that. What happens is then, because it's so lucrative, the whole population says, my God, let's grow cotton. So the whole country gives up all the things that makes the national sovereignty, the power of that structure that has been built for thousands of years. And then they say, cotton is the way to go. My God, we're going to make a fortune. We can go and travel and, you know, enjoy ourselves, you know, have a wonderful time. So everybody starts having cotton fields. You went through Somalia, cotton fields. And once that was done, after a few years down the road, the World Bank said, I'm really sorry, I don't know what happened, but sorry, we're going to buy it from Gambia instead, you know. So suddenly Somalia, that was a powerful nation before, just went into total chaos because they couldn't sell the cotton, and all the other crops and so on that fed the population people, suddenly it wasn't there. It was just cotton. You can't eat cotton. So the whole country just went boom. Within 2 years, it was down the drain. No money, no nothing. And no wonder that people start getting frustrated. When you are hungry, not a fun place to be. That is when blood sugar goes low, you get irritated, these things. So very easy to fuel a conflict. So they go in, they start pumping in money, weapons, all of these things. And here we have a war that we can keep on going forever and ever. No, it's a civil war. It's been going on for 15 years. Yeah, but how did it start? And why is it still there? Look at these different wars globally. You will see the same thing popping up. Again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Same story. And we're thinking, my God, these people, you know, with dark skin, why can they not be friends? Look at us, we're civilized. No, I'm sorry, we're not. We are the ones that are funding, are supporting the structure behind this slavery. Not okay. It is not okay. It is time to stop it by exposing it.
Those are the things you know about, but however, he doesn't bring out that these countries, in many cases, were extremely primitive and all that stuff long before, you know, for thousands of years. However, they have learned to live in that kind of a society, and at least a few of them can better themselves quite a bit using modern farming practices and so forth. But but what happens with the capitalistas, the predatory capitalists, they just make the problem much worse. They start out by, like he says, giving them a carrot on a stick, and then they get them in, and then they rake them over and take over, and pretty soon there's civil war. And then the worst thing is to give all these niggers guns and bombs and planes and stuff like that. So here's another group of psychopaths that need to be dealt with. It's too bad there's not a international vigilante system dedicated to only one thing, and that's putting an end to this kind of stuff. But not at the bottom, at the top. But it's very doubtful that that's going to happen. And of course, the other thing he didn't talk about was the fact that when a country goes down a tube like that and then there's civil war, it's when they all start running for the border, running for any country that can get them, any place they can get out of the way. And if they can get to Europe, and then like some of these people are demanding down in Hungary, that got to Hungary, we want to go to Germany or Austria. You know, now they're demanding what country they want to go to, not just to save their life, but to get into a country that's got a higher economic standard. And we don't want this to go into any place. We don't want to just survive. We want what you got. They're not going to say that. That's the name of the game. We'll come in there with our hat in hand and crying about how horrible it is in our country. But once we're in there and we get a few rights, you know, then watch out. Now, it seems like Hungary is going to be where the battleground really gets ferocious, because they're using the ploy, which is effective. It's a good ploy that they are alone the country that's protecting the EU. In other words, they're the line that they're trying to hold these refugees off, these invaders, this invading biological army. Reminds me of back when the Mongoloids were invading Europe. Hungary was in the lurch then too. So Hungary seems to be the battle line for all Europe. So, but at least so far, they've kept the dam closed to keep them from crossing Hungary, even though there's many of them already in there trying to riot and get on the trains and everything else. They can call it this horrible right wing fascism and all that, but they're going to have to use it if they're going to survive at all. They're going to have to use it. Some leader's going to have to start it. It'll be another Hitler. Oh my God. It's funny, a lot of these invaders that tried to get on the train down there in Hungary, roughly 500 people staying on the train. They got onto the train yesterday when Budapest's main Kaliti train station opened up to them after a two-day lockdown, during which the authorities didn't let anybody without a valid European Union visa board the trains. While refugees or invaders expected the train to travel to Western Europe, it stopped at a refugee camp just outside the Hungarian capital, quote, where riot police were waiting to take the refugees to an overcrowded facility that many had left a few days earlier in hopes of finding sanctuary in Germany. Roughly 500 people stayed on the train, and many of them are vowing to go on hunger strike unless they're taken to Germany. Well, go on a hunger strike. That's a good solution. Go on a hunger strike. And you're never going to get to Germany. looks to me like there's going to be radical politics real fast in Europe and the United States, too. How determined it will be is another question. I think the day of the crying their eyes out for the invaders around the world is about over. However, if the U.S. military-industrial complex doesn't back off and just keeps pounding the hell out of these countries in the Middle East and other places, then the question is going to be a question, what the hell is going to happen? No matter what you think of ISIS, the best thing that could happen is if they are successful in driving Western forces completely out of the Middle East. The end result would be much better for the rest of us, that's for sure. Because they're not interested in invading Europe. They're not interested in invading the United States. They just want to have their caliphate there as they had back before World War I in the Middle East. The big insanity is like with Britain. They're going to allow thousands more invaders from camps near the Syrian border into Britain. After the image of a drowned 3-year-old boy on the beach in Turkey after fleeing his home country of Syria sparked outrage around the world, several European leaders urged British Prime Minister David Cameron to accept more people into the country. And Cameron said on Friday morning that the government would act with our head and our heart. Well, your stupid head and your stupid heart. So one kid drowns on the beach and you're going to sink your whole country? Just think of that, how small England is, allowing thousands of these more of these people coming in. They'll either resist this and turn it around or they're through. They're through, we're through, everybody's through. Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, is also planning to propose a plan next week that would increase the number of people EU countries would take in for temporary refuge. You wonder whether the whole EU may have been set up looking forward to something like this happening, to where they could have this EU government that's passing rules for all the countries to make the big decisions, and the individual countries will be made to go along with it. Juncker is proposing a mandatory sharing of roughly 160,000 refugees between 25 of the EU's 28 countries. Britain, Ireland, Denmark are exempt because of protocols agreed upon in the EU's 2008 Lisbon Treaty. Now that's interesting. Britain, Ireland, and Denmark are exempt. Well, but Britain wants to change it and take them in? Ah, jeez. Madness, man. Madness. And what dominates our press here in the United States? Whether some small town clerk in Kentucky won't let a couple of queers get married? This is becoming a great big deal among the Christians in this country, you know. I think the problem is we're wasting our time on small problems, if they're problems. It drives me up the walls to think of men and women marrying, but it's not something we can not get around. But these other problems are what are the big problems. And so this gal is going to become the Joan of Arc of the Christians in the United States, the fundamentalists. You know, they threw her in jail. Anything to keep their eyes off the big issues. Well, tax money, $243 million in 1 week has been spent on fighting wildfires across the country. 8 million acres have burned. That reminds me, and I think I told you about this sometime, my father was an engineer at Caltech. Also, he became an engineer for the Naval Weapons Bureau. And he proposed one time that they use rockets to put out these fires. And with these military rockets, they could do that. Because when a rocket with a lot of explosive hits a fire area, it takes all the oxygen out of the air and would put out the fire. Local newspaper got a hold of it and printed up an article and made him look like a crazy man, so he said, I'll never do that again. So he never made any suggestions after that. So there's 70 wildfires are currently burning, and a lot of those have been set by human beings. Wetbacks have been known to start a lot of them. Yep, that's it. Well, anyhow, it's another more so-called bad news. It's going to force a lot of white people who've moved out into the forests and so forth and to get away from Niggerville, be forced them back into the cities. That's another thing that I don't think the system's too unhappy about. I think it was interesting, too, that they were bringing in regular army troops to help fight the fires. What happened to the National Guard? Are they all over in Afghanistan? I'd like to know. So the Forest Service is going to be spending about $200 million a week to try to put these fires out. Well, I see the Ninth Circuit Solicitor Scarlett Wilson said Thursday that South Carolina prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for white young man Dylan Roof, the 21-year-old accused of fatally shooting 9 black prisoners or parishioners in a historic Charleston church. Quote, this was the ultimate crime, and justice for our state calls for the ultimate punishment. I don't think it's the ultimate crime, Wilson said in a news conference. Wilson said she had several meetings with survivors and victims and families who stood strong in the face of such a tremendous and profound loss. Gee, they don't seem to meet with white people when they're ravished and raped and murdered by these animals. She added that while some did not believe in the death penalty, citing their religious beliefs, others felt that the death penalty is just too easy. Others believed that the death penalty was entirely appropriate, for Wilson described heinous acts that changed the future of 10 families forever. Well, I think he's got a choice. I think he should take the death penalty because it's a shot in the arm and you're gone. Otherwise, you're going to spend the rest of your life in a hellhole prison someplace. You'll be raped and everything else over and over again. And so I think you're better to take the needle. Of course, that's easy for me to say. Well, it looks like the Black Ku Klux Klan is hard at work. An 11-year-old shot a 16-year-old suspect in a home invasion in St. Louis, Missouri. Police are still investigating the matter. One person is dead and two are wounded after shooting in a parking lot of a college campus in Sacramento, California. And Chicago saw its deadly day in more than a decade on Wednesday as 8 people were killed in homicides. I wonder how many of those were black. When that temperature goes up there, boy, and it gets up into the 90s, the animals get real restless. If you want to read the interview of the person who wrote the article on Donald Trump and the white nationalists, go to www.newyorker.com/magazine/2015/8/31st, The Fearful and the Catched. Anyhow, just get to the New Yorker, you pick it up. Or go to Fresh Air on PBS in their storage area. Well, that's it for Freya's Day, and I'll be back on Moon's Day with more exciting news about how the world is going to hell according to the white race. And what we should be doing about it, but that's questionable. Yeah. Bye-bye.